cinemaker Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 4, Fallen Angels episode The Quiet Room from 1993. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Tobin Addington.
And this is the first real misstep that we have here in Cinemakers. This is, I don't want to call this garbage, but it's kind of garbage.
What is this? Is this a television show?
I looked it up, yeah. So this was a show that was on Showtime.
Okay, I thought it was like an anthology film at first.
No, it's a Showtime show that aired 2 seasons, one in 93 and one in 95. And I think it was about 6 episodes per season or something. It's an American neo-noir anthology television series that was produced by Propaganda Films. The series as a whole is set in somber Los Angeles right after World War II and before the election of John F. Kennedy. And each episode begins with a cool, and this is all direct quotes from Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Each episode begins with a cool and restrained jazz score as the sultry character Faye Friendly explains to the audience what would develop in the episode. Her words are wistful, melancholic, and foreshadowed the pain to come.
She's like the crypt keeper for this show,
yes.
Right? Like, I was getting that kind of vibe halfway through. I was like, whoa. Good idea for a show, though, like a neo-noir limited series that semi-connects together. I kind of like the concept, but this did not pan out well.
What's really strange about this is that unlike the first 3 things we watched, Soderbergh did not write this, he did not edit this, and aside from Peter Gallagher, it doesn't seem like anybody he sort of worked with up till this point is involved here. Like, there's no Cliff Martinez music, there's just, there's nothing here aside from maybe one shot that I took note of that would give you any indication that this was Steven Soderbergh behind the camera. It's just, it's so restrained, and it's just boring.
Yeah, it's extremely generic, and it feels like more of some, kind of a director for hire thing. You know, like, it doesn't feel like it has his stamp. And I don't know why you would hire Soderbergh. I mean, like I said, I wish you wouldn't hire Soderbergh and then not let him do his thing. Now, maybe they did. Maybe I'm just assuming that because he's gone on to do even sort of work in this genre later on to much better effect, sort of just assuming that it's the producer's fault, that it's Showtime's fault, that it's the writer of the show's fault, that it, you know, can't be Soderbergh. This is where my brain kind of goes. Of course, maybe it is. Maybe this is just a, you know, just as you say, just a complete misstep for him. But you're right, it does not feel like his show at all.
Yeah, and the only thing I could keep thinking of was maybe he wanted to try the TV format, like sort of a shorter format. You know, this is in full frame, you know, so it's sort of not what he's used to, or not what, it's not in the realm of feature. So I thought maybe he did this to test those waters out a little bit and see how that felt. And yeah, I'm sure even at this point he had, you know, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, but after that, those 2 other movies, I'm not sure that was gaining him acclaim. They were kind of, he was coasting a little bit, I feel, maybe at this point. And so I could understand taking a job for hire or not having total complete control over it, stuff of that nature. So that's sort of where my head was going at this. It felt like someone who was doing something to sort of test himself. I mean, he's still doing period work here, which is tough. He hasn't come back to present day since Sex Lies. So I don't know what else could be going on, except like it is possible that he has a love of noir film, which is evident in his previous work. So like I mentioned, I felt like this is an intriguing idea, concept for a show, but whoever was behind the scenes, who was ever really in control, had it their way. I don't really get a sense of his style here.
It is, oh man, like there's, the only shot that I saw that was really noteworthy was when Joe Mantegna and that lady cop were walking down that set of stairs, and it sort of follows them, like it's this cool sort of swivelly tracking shot that looked cool, but the rest of it is just like, it feels like a commercial, like there's, especially maybe just the beginning, maybe just that opening with Faye Friendly.
That felt like a perfume commercial, absolutely.
There's so many extreme close-ups and insert shots of just objects, and I'm like, what is going on here? Like, why is any of this happening? It's so bizarre.
Did you guys see who shot it, who the cinematographer was? It's Emmanuel Lubezki, who you guys already talked about. He did A Walk in the Clouds, but then went on to do things like Y Tu Mama Tambien and a bunch of Malick stuff, The New World and To the Wonder and Song to Song, it's out now. And then he did The Revenant and Gravity and Birdman. And
oh, Whoa.
Burn After Reading, Children of Men. Like, this is a guy who is very good. Now, he may not be good at this, or, you know, this feels like a mismatch for him a little bit, too, given the kind of handheld realism that he excels at in a lot of the other work. But it's sort of a departure that way. I would have to imagine that a lot of the blame goes to the script. I don't know how you make this movie. It seems to, you know, to begin with a not very good concept and then be executed rather poorly, where a lot of really important action happens off screen, and where, like, I don't really care what's happening to the characters long after I have guessed, or so long before I've guessed how it's all going to end. It's not even quite an exercise in style, right? Like, it feels like it could have been an exercise in style, but the style itself isn't even that accomplished.
Yeah, I only made a note for one shot myself, and it was the glass table shot. I mean, it's not an actual glass table, but it's like shot from underneath the glass, and he's throwing the money down. And I thought that was really interesting. I was like, okay, there's that. To me, felt like where the rest of this could have gone. Like, noir needs to have dark shadows and high style. It's noir, you know, like it's it's highly stylized, and this felt like a soap opera set in the 50s or something, or in the 40s. Like, this just felt like it lacked any kind of style to me. So that was unfortunate. It didn't help the boring story either. And and maybe it's not that the story is boring. It's just what it tried to do, as far as I could tell, was make the audience play catch up. Like, you would see something happen on screen and be like, what the hell's going on? And then the next scene, someone would explain what's going on. Like, for instance, Joe Montana would bust some guy for prostitution, and you're like, what's going on? And the next scene, he meets up with this hooker feeding him info about, you know, reputable men that need to go, that he should like check out, and would get sort of awarded for bringing in to justice and whatever. Like, I guess that's the racket going on during this whole thing. I'm not totally sure, but that is, to me, like, that takes a certain tact, and you need to set a lot of that up visually, and you can't just present stuff like this and call it noir. It doesn't fit right for me.
You know, made me wonder if this is kind of the tyranny of narrative that they talked about last time in the video essay about King of the Hill. That this feels like someone oppressed by narrative. This feels like someone who is sort of forced to tell this ABCD story in a sort of straightforward way. Whether it's because he can't figure out how to do it, doesn't have time to figure out how to do it another way. Or is it equipped to do it yet another way? Because, you know, he's still a young guy. Like, he's still a young filmmaker, you know? And I feel like, you know, if this was the first thing he ever did, then we would look at it and say, oh, look, he's playing in the noir space a little bit. And it's kind of interesting. It's not very good. I can't wait till we get to better stuff. I think part of it is the fact that he came out of the gate with such a command of cinema. And then this feels like, you know, just kind of dull. This just feels kind of dull. It is sort of unfortunate.
And I don't know why he did this, because there's a couple books that I've sort of been reading as we watch a movie and we talk about a movie, and neither of them has a chapter or a part of a chapter about this. The only thing that I read about this was, like I mentioned in the last episode, that he's just like, oh, I'm also doing this thing for Showtime or whatever, and he mentions this sort of offhandedly. But I don't know where this came from. I guess they must have just liked him and just like, hey, here's X amount of money for, I can't imagine was too much work in terms of time. You don't have to edit it. You don't have to write it. Just come in and do your thing, and we'll slap your hot, like, up-and-coming name on the TV show, and it's a win-win. I don't know why else this would have happened, but I can't see a more established director doing this, I don't think, because didn't we say, like, Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks also directed other episodes of this?
And Alfonso Cuarón, too.
Right, so, like, it's not, I mean, they're all big names now, but I mean, Tom Cruise was obviously a superstar actor by that time, but, like, it's not like they're getting really huge. Like, they're not, like, Steven Spielberg is not doing one of these in 1993.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Tom Cruise isn't going on to direct anything after.
Right.
Tom Hanks will go on to have somewhat of a lackluster directorial career and do very safe films, but nothing like Alfonso Cuarón or anything.
It's just bizarre.
Another thing I kept thinking of was maybe he really wanted to work with Joe Mantegna.
Maybe.
Because he's like a great, great actor, and he's known for doing a lot of Mamet work, and just like, you know, he's a superstar of the stage, and like his screen work's amazing, and he's such a presence. Maybe, I mean, if he was like, if this comes across your table and you're like, ah, what is this? Like, what is worth doing this for? And it's like, well, to work with Joe Mantegna, sure. Like, there's a chance, you know, I could just do this nifty little noir thing and maybe try and, you know, work out like any of my Mamet issues over it and see how that gets me over. But that's just something that crossed my mind.
The only thing I could find online in terms of motivation was, it was just speculation, but it's somebody who's doing a deep dive sort of movie by movie, kind of like we are into Soderbergh, and their sort of chronology of it is that, so he comes out of the gate with Sex Lies and it's this big thing, and then and it's very successful commercially and critically. And then he makes Kafka, which everybody knows is not going to be a big commercial success, given how kind of esoteric a film it is. And then King of the Hill comes out, and that's sort of his attempt to do a more accessible film, and that bombs. And about the time that that's bombing, he signs on or is about to start making this. And that their idea is that maybe he was in that, because there was a big thing in the early days of the 90s indie film movement in America to do sort of one for them, one for me, right? So you make one film for sort of studios, you make one film for the paycheck, and then you make one film that's your sort of your personal film. And if you can bounce back and forth between those two, you can maintain your sort of personal voice and also be able to make more films because you've been sort of commercially successful. So there's a possibility that this was a paycheck gig. We're about to move on to a film where has talked about being sort of checked out in terms of his own personal attention making it, right? So if you think about this as maybe a step toward the underneath, that might be, it might sort of explain, you know, that this is the point that he's going to sink to in order to reinvent himself into the filmmaker that he is to this day.
That makes sense. And I can also see this as a way that, like, maybe Mantegna was already attached, and he's like, and they were like, hey, but you can fill this out with whoever else you want, because he would get back Peter Gallagher from Sex Lies, who would then also go on to star in The Underneath. He would get Bonnie Bedelia after Die Hard, so that's cool, right? And then he has Vanessa Shaw, who will return way, way down the line in Side Effects. It's all just, I mean, it's all just guesswork on our part, and that thing that, Tobin, you were mentioning online, it's just, after such, I mean, even though you guys didn't seem to love King of the Hill, I mean, to go from that to this, it's just such a step down, it's just a bummer. And also, I mean, I know this is not, we shouldn't judge it on this merit alone, but going from that gorgeous, you know, Criterion Blu-ray to this, you know, VHS upload on YouTube with Danish subtitles, like, it's just, that is not helping this either. I feel like if this was in really, like decent quality, I mean, I know this is 20 years old, there's no, like, HD anything out of this anywhere, but if it was better quality, I think it would suit it better. But the fact that, like, the noir elements, like you were mentioning earlier, Mike, that the shadows and the coloring and stuff is muted by this sort of fuzzy-looking upload, that's not helping us or this viewing anything. It's not helping it at all.
Yeah, I also wonder if we were watching this when it aired, you know, if we were fans of the show, or if we were just watching it and had seen other episodes to compare this to, so we would know, like, maybe this is the best that there is. Maybe he's had a look at all the scripts and this was the only one left. I mean, there's so many things to wonder about when it comes to this, but it's fun to wonder. But it just, it's a little strange. Well, it's very strange, but what's weird about it is that, like, how, like you guys were saying, and how just by the book and how bland and all of that it is, like, I can't kind of get over that and how far he's going to have to bounce back. I guess that's what I'm getting at, is like he fell, it seems like he fell far quickly, like between this and what we're going to get to next week, which I have only seen parts of, but to go, like, it's making me like King of the Hill all that much more, because there's so much more there. If you're not there for the plot, there's, like, the look. If you're not there for that, there's the plot. I mean, there's stuff there to draw attention and to entertain, and I'm just not feeling it here. It's unfortunate.
You know, the other thing that this movie demonstrated, that this episode of television demonstrates, is that sort of 30s, 40s, classical Hollywood film noir dialogue is really hard to write and really hard to pull off. You know, there has to be, sort of by nature, there's a lot of deceptive exposition in those movies. And this tries to do that, I think, and just sort of falls completely on its face, as far as I can tell. And I think people maybe think it's easy, you know, or that it's just not as difficult to do, not as difficult to pull off. But I and Montaigne should be able to do it, right? Like the Mamet school should be quite well suited to film noir. And Michael, I like what you were saying. This is a great idea for a show. I wish they, you know, that they were doing something like this, you know, not at all like this, not the way this has been executed, but as an idea, I think it's a really good one. It just is probably much harder to pull off than some people realize.
Yeah, not to really harp on the style much more, but I feel like if you're going to do a period noir, it needs to be black and white through and through for the most part. You could do like L.A. Confidential gets away with it because that's a terrific movie, but I feel like if you're going to do neo-noir, that to me rings like more of a modern bell. Like if it's going to be color, it should take place today or close to, maybe, you know, as far back as the 70s or 60s or something. But that was throwing me off because I'm just not used to or acclimated to colored noir from the past. I feel like that was just sort of something that threw me, and, you know, on top of everything else, it just didn't help.
No, it did not. I'm already out of things to talk about with this. I mean, it's short. It's only 28 minutes long. It's on YouTube if you want to watch it. I mean, don't watch it, but if you want to. But is there anything else that we want to talk about with this? I mean, there's only one other little, I feel like there's only, well, there, no, there's a couple. There's two more little side ventures that we're going to hit on the Soderbergh journey. One is coming up in 3 weeks. He did the concert documentary or concert movie for Yes from 1985, actually before Sex Lies. So we're doing that as a little bit of a bonus a few weeks down. And then there's that one, I want to say it's either K Street or Keen or Eros. Like, there's one that's just sort of like a short film. But like, this is one of the very few sidestep things that we have from his main filmography. And I mean, we're 0 for 1 so far.
Yeah, the other smaller things that are, I don't know, but I've not seen the Yes concert, but in terms of his segment of Eros, or then when he gets into, which isn't a single film, but three filmmakers make, it's sort of three, built of three short films, and he directs one of them. But this is the only one of his sort of non-feature film projects that is not of his own devising. This and the other episode of Fallen Angels that thankfully we can't find on YouTube.
I forgot he did a second one. Yeah.
Oh man.
For the second season. I mean, sure he you know, he signed up to do one a season as long as it ran or whatever the contract would have been, right? So thankfully we can't find that. But everything after this, in terms of the sidesteps, whether they're good or not, I'm not saying that they'll all be great, but they will all be of his own conception. And I think that will make a difference.
Because when Mike and I were originally putting together the idea for this podcast, we were sort of roughly calling it the Modern Auteurs Podcast. And we really wanted things that, like, movies that were written and directed by a single person that you could see their style influenced over this. And it feels like, this seems negative, but it also feels like it might be true that because he didn't write this, he doesn't feel connected to it. And so he's not invested in, like, creating original shots or, like, telling a visual story because it's not his script. And so it's tough to do something like this to see where, you know, we have three movies up front where it's original screenplays or adaptations from things that he's so invested in from start to finish. And here, it's just like, here's a script, go make it. And you can just sort of see that, like, this is, again, a guess, but, like, it just feels like the passion isn't there. Like, he's not doing anything to really put his signature or his flair on it.
Yeah, his best stuff, if he's not writing it, and he does not write, you know, alone a lot of his movies, but the best ones are ones that he's been involved in deeply in the way they're conceived and working with the writer, you know, structuring the film and figuring out what the world is and creating the characters. You know, he's deeply involved in it, and it's, you'd have to imagine he was not that involved in this. This feels like something he was just handed to say, go shoot this. And so he sort of did.
I think if anything, this episode will at least prove that he is an auteur. Like, he's going to be doing the more interesting stuff when he's in total control. Like, some filmmakers are out of control when they're in total control, and they need to be reined in by studios and can't write and direct. But I feel like this little 30, 28 minutes or whatever we watched is like a lot of evidence to the fact that, like, he's better when he's left to his own devices for the most part, or at least is given, like, the control that he wants at the time, because he was like a cog in the machine during this. I feel like that's why it's not up there with any of his better work, right? Like, in fact, this might be his worst stuff. It certainly is at this point, but, you know, we'll find out. But that's basically what I'm getting the most here today, is when he's given the freedom that he wants, he'll do great work.
You know, what's interesting comes to mind as you say that is that a lot of the filmmakers who get free rein and then that causes problems for them are, you know, that's a common thing. And we may disagree about who those filmmakers might be who are given a lot of money and then sort of jump the shark. But Soderbergh's always, one of the things that he begins to do after the next couple movies is provide limits for himself. He finds ways to say, okay, I'm going to, between these big studio movies, I'm going to go make a movie that I'm only going to make for $1 million or $200,000 with just local actors and or non-actors and a script by a playwright. And, you know, he's going to go do things like that to sort of keep him honest, you know, to keep him challenged in a way. So he's not just going to the craft service table and having pheasant under glass while the crew sets up the next shot or whatever. You know, like he's going to provide those limits for himself, even if they're not imposed from beyond. And if I can make one argument for watching this, and it's the only one I can make, is that I think to truly understand the arc of his filmography and the arc of his career, you have to journey to the depths like this. Like, you have to come to something that is, it's not that there's anything specifically wrong with it or bad about it. It's just, it's so deadeningly dull and he's just not invested in it at all. And that I think he had to come to this place in order to eventually get to where he's going. And I think I'm glad he made this, because if he hadn't, he may have made three feature films that were this dull, and then we'd never have heard from him again, you know? So that's the only argument I can make for sort of watching this, is to get a sense of the arc of his career.
Yeah, I like that. But also, counterpoint is just know that this exists, and know that that's what sort of propelled his career, and just be okay with not spending 28 minutes of your time watching this. But that is a good point. I like that. Any other last thoughts about Fallen Angels, The Quiet Room?
Only that my last note on the page here is, this is horrid in its banality. That was my summation.
That's a good pull quote.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything else to add. I'm glad that we're not going on too many side quests during this adventure, you know, and that the this first one is seemingly going to be the worst one. So fingers are crossed that the worst is behind us.
Yeah. So if you want to hear the other episodes that we've done for this or the other shows on our network, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or Twitter at cageclubpod and see all the shows that we've done, all the other episodes we've done, lots of fun free things for you to listen to and read at those three places. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Tobin Addington.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.